19. Animals go to ground where they feel safe, Marshall knew. And humans were animals. It was instinct, operating underneath all the fancy curls of gray matter, down in the low parts of the brain. Home territory was so fundamental a concept, so basic, that it could trip up even the cleverest of criminals. But there was an exception to this rule. Addicts. Addicts couldn't go back. Once in their old haunts, they started using again. His leads would not take him anywhere that clean and sober Lexi might be found. He had to look earlier. 30 to 50 years earlier. He had to find her in her childhood. Impossible, but what else did he have? He could not tuck tail, give up, slink back to Bree, and sit with her through the long hours of the night. Unendurable. So he did his due diligence, driving to the neighborhood where Lexi'd grown up. Coral's house, in person, looked so innocuous. Just a tidy frame ranch with a carport, like most of the others in this speck of a town, crouched low between two mountains. It was past 9:30, and knocking on doors this late in the country was a good way to get himself shot. He knocked anyway, starting with Coral's old house. The new resident was a small, grumpy woman in her 40s. Marshall could hear two or three other voices inside, teenagers or older kids, squabbling. He flashed his PI's license and used the same lie he had offered Gabrielle, about working for a law firm seeking the Pines with news about an inheritance. Both the story and the heavier southern accent he unleashed to tell it played well with her. It would be good for most anyone in this working-class, rural neighborhood with its tidy lawns and older, well-kept cars. He knew, because he'd grown up on a street much like this. Back on Toby Leland's block, folks would have assumed he was a cop or a bounty hunter or a loan shark, lying, seeking the Pines with bad intentions. Here, the woman warmed near instantly. She'd only met Coral at the closing, she said, but she pointed out the houses of the residents who had lived here longest. Marshall hit those houses first, talking to about 10 neighbors in total. They'd all known the Pines well enough, as one said, to borrow sugar from, but none were truly close with Coral. She had left no forwarding address. Only one couple had even known she was ill, and she'd downplayed it with them. They had no idea where she might be now. He was grinding. If this led him to Lexi, it would take a level of luck most lottery winners didn't get. Maybe he should ask around at the sparse local businesses. He'd seen a DQ and a gas station with a hot bar in it on the way, close. Perhaps someone working in one of those places had known the Pines. He should hurry. They would close soon, and every minute that passed felt like time shaved off of Robert's already so brief life. He was walking back to his car when his phone rang. Bree. He knew it, heartsick. He didn't want to answer. She was a single, exposed nerve. She would know from his hello how poorly things were going. He looked at the caller ID and saw it was Gabrielle. Her name was a reprieve. Hey, he said.
They knew the Dentons!
She yelled it, almost. He'd been so deep in his own failure, it took him a sec to remember who the Dentons were. The owners of Fun Time. Her excitement sparked his. Tell me, he said.
They were members at the same church. When Lexi's father was alive, the Pine family went to Fun Time almost every Sunday. They'd have a picnic, let Lexi ride the carousel, and eat pink and yellow cotton candy. She didn't like the blue. The families were close, so close they gave Coral a job at Funtime after her husband died.
Her information was so detailed. You talked to them.
I talked to her, Mariah. Her husband is deceased. I did use your inheritance story, so thanks for that. She's in her 80s, but still has her own apartment in an assisted living place in Dawsonville. You know where that is?
I do, he said, but she was still talking.
She moved there to be near her sister's children and grands. That's all I got, because she has a hard time on the phone. Her hearing isn't good. But she knows that Coral is sick. You understand? That means she talked to her after the diagnosis. If you drive over, she says she'll talk to you.
He was already turning the car around. This light?
Yes. Her place has its own entry, and she sets her own hours, she says. She's feisty. She told me, "Honey, don't you know old ladies never sleep?" She'll be up if you can get there before midnight.
He could be there by 11:30 if he gunned it. You are amazing, he told her.
I know, she said, cocky.
It made him grin, re-energized.
So are you. We're going to get Robert back, Marshall.
As he got off the phone, he was praying she was right. He drove southwest in the darkness, and her hope stayed with him. Gabrielle had found a close family friend, a former employer, one who had known child Lexi, sober Lexi, one who'd been in contact with Coral Pine after her diagnosis. She might straight up know, or at least have a damn good guess where Lexi was. She would definitely know Lexi's pre-addiction safe spots, friends, contacts. His odds had just dropped from lotto level to a long shot in a horse race. He could work with that. Speeding toward an interview that seemed like something solid, he felt as if a heavy cloud of fog had cleared. In the space, he found himself thinking of Trey's story. The events Trey had recounted were more than enough to send a vulnerable girl, one already prone to self-medication, and away for the first time from the sharp judgment and rigid rules of a difficult mother, into a spiral that would end in addiction and prison time. The story confirmed that Spence was exactly the asshole that Marshall had known. So Lexi's history could have played out that way. Bree clearly believed it. But deep in the logical left side of his brain, the chilly piece that housed his inner cop was calling bullshit. The tail left Trey's hands too clean. Trey, who was a good guy, came off as absolutely the goodest guy humanly possible given the circumstances. The drugs, the threesome, none of these things had been Trey's idea. He'd been tempted and pulled in, like some dewy maiden being coaxed inch by inch off her unicorn. In Trey's version, the deepest moral blame belonged to Adam, the guy that Trey liked the least. Spence, who was dead, got thrown a little ways under a bus, too, for pushing and orchestrating. Lexi came off sympathetic, which made Trey sympathetic for presenting her that way. But still, she had instigated the whole night and brought the drugs. And yet, Trey was such a good guy in this tale that he didn't point a judgy finger at her. Instead, he'd done some straight-up hero work. First, punching Adam, who had dearly needed punching, then burning the pictures, seeking out Lexi, giving her the money. The more Marshall thought about the story, the more it curdled in his guts. If a perp had tried to float this fairy tale by him in a small gray room, bullshit, bullshit, bullshit. But then, Trey was not some perp. Trey was, by any measure, a decent person. He had his faults, like anyone. Impatient at times, definitely used to getting his way. But he was a loving dad and a faithful husband, generous with friends and charities, an excellent employer, fair and good-humored. So, yeah, there was all that. What if the story, then, was simply mostly true? The mind revises, Marshall knew. He'd always believe a fingerprint over an eyewitness. As time passed, events became mutable. People justified their actions, and the more shame they felt about a memory, the more they chewed it over, fretting and defending and editing, until they could live with it. Trey's very decency made him more apt to reframe a story like the one he'd told Bree, at least a little. Or a lot. Or maybe Marshall only thought that because he was so stupid in love with Trey's wife. He was in Dawsonville proper now, getting close. He had to pay attention to his GPS. Anyway, his reaction to Trey's story would not help him find Lexi, so screw it. It was a problem for tomorrow or the next day, when Robert was safe home. Bickford Independent Living Community was three long, slightly run-down buildings full of single-floor apartments, each with its own door. There was a shabby clubhouse and a small pool, but no office where he had to check in. The parking spaces were numbered, but every five slots or so there was a space marked visitor. He found an empty one close to Mariah Denton's place and went to knock on her door. It opened almost at once. She'd been waiting for him. He recognized her from the picture. Clearly the same woman, but shorter and rounder. Her brown hair had thinned and silvered, but it was still long, wound up in a crown of slender braids. She wore a hot pink lounge set that could have been pajamas or a tracksuit, and had bright green reading glasses on a string around her neck. "Mrs. Denton, I'm Marshall Chase," he said, holding out his hand to shake. Instead, she grasped his forearm and pulled him in, smiling.
Come in, young man. Anything I can do to help Lexi and Cora Lee. I've been racking my poor brains, trying to think where they might be staying. I'm sure I don't know."
A disappointment, but not a huge one. He hadn't expected it would be that easy. Just hoped. Mariah Denton was assuming that the two of them were together, though. They weren't. Coral, who read mysteries and thrillers, would be too smart to let her daughter stick a toe inside the room or house where she was holding a kidnapped infant. Lexi was a felon, with fingerprints and probably DNA logged in the system. Coral wouldn't want Lexi anywhere near fun time tomorrow, either. She had no way to know if Bree would bring Trey or the cops to meet her. Mrs. Denton was still talking.
"Oh, the bad luck that family has had, I tell you. It's so nice a good thing is happening, and with Coral Lee so sick, I know they could use the money."
She was a chatterbox. That could be good or bad, depending on how well he could keep her on topic. He let himself be tugboated to the small kitchen behind the breakfast bar while she nattered on about the fictional inheritance. Gabrielle had prepped her well. A three-seater table with a floral plastic cover was pushed against the wall. She deposited him by one of the ladder-back chairs, and he obediently sat down. She hovered by him.
"I was thinking I might make myself some cocoa, if you give me the excuse."
"I'd love some." It was late, and she was elderly. Sugar and caffeine would buy him more time with her. "Do you have a way to contact either of the Pines?" he asked before she could start up her monologue again. She went toward the fridge and got the milk out.
"Well, I thought I did. As soon as I got off the phone with the young lady at your law firm, I tried the number Coral Lee left. It's not connected anymore. I thought for a moment she must have passed on. She was very ill. But Lexi surely would have contacted me about the funeral. More likely it's off because of money troubles, so an inheritance would be an answered prayer. Is it enough money to be useful?"
She had bright black eyes, shiny as buttons, and she hardly paused for breath or answers.
I can't give you specifics, but it's a comfortable amount. Can I see the phone number? He asked. When did she give it to you?
Why, it must be 5 or 6 months back at least, when she was staying here. I have a guest room, you know.
As she told him every detail of her small apartment's layout, she opened a kitchen drawer and got an old-fashioned paper address book, the kind with 3 whole punch pages that could be changed out. It looked almost as old as she was. She flipped through the crackly yellowed pages, then set it down in front of him, wishing aloud that she had a 2-bath unit instead of just a 1/2 bath in the front. Coral Lee had to come through the master to shower. The address was for the old house with the carport, the one he'd so recently visited. A phone number was crossed out, and a new one had been written above in fresher, brighter ink. Area code 762. Was that Georgia? It was probably a burner, but he took a picture of the whole page anyway and sent it in a text to Gabrielle that said, Coral Lee Pine's most recent number. What's this area code? Cell phone? Traceable? While he was doing this, Mariah got out a pan and poured milk into it, not measuring, talking on unchecked. Something about a cat now. He wasn't sure how she'd gotten there. At the first sign of a pause, he put in, Does Lexi have any close friends around here, or in her old neighborhood? She was adding Dutch cocoa and sugar to her pan, again not measuring, but she paused to say carefully,
You know Lexi had some troubles.
He nodded, grave. I am familiar with her history. She went to work with a whisk, her dark eyes gleaming whenever she glanced at him.
Well, good then. I wouldn't want to gossip. When Coralie showed up 6 months back, I knew it was about Lexi.
Mariah Denton lived right behind her eyes, and every word falling from her crinkly pink mouth had the ring of gospel. If he could ask the right questions, she would tell him what he needed to know. Had you stayed in touch? He asked.
Not really, just Christmas cards after the church split. I try to get my cards out, but...
The church that you went to together split? He interrupted. He needed to get a rhythm going with her. Question, answer.
Yes, over doctrine. The congregation simply shattered. Pastor Farley left town in the dead of night like a criminal, and the bank took the building. After that, Larry and I got our preaching off the radio. Now that he's passed, I take the shuttle bus to the Methodist Church. It's nice. They have a dedicated minister for seniors.
He nudged her gently back on track. The church you attended with Mrs. Pine, was it Methodist too? That made her laugh.
Oh, Lord, no. Larry said the Methodists were full of nonsense.
Her whisk paused.
I hope that doesn't offend you.
No, ma'am, though I am a Methodist, Marshall said, smiling. He liked her, overshares and all, but he did not have time to indulge her much. She smiled back.
We went to a non-denominational church called Christ Redeemer. That was Larry's pick. He was a good, dear man, but he needed things a certain way. None of it bothered me enough to want to make it a bone of contention.
A certain way? Marshall asked. To get a sense of it.
Oh, he didn't think there ought to be musical instruments in the church, and he didn't hold with dancing or wine or mixed bathing or card games, even crazy eights. Larry used to say, Give me a church that's just plain Bible. Nothing added, nothing took away.
Her tone was wry but fond.
Never mind King David in the Psalms talking all about drums and lyres and dancing. If I pointed that out, though, he'd get all foamy and preach at me. And I like a cappella singing fine.
She was drifting off topic again. Mrs. Pine was like Larry in her beliefs?
I suppose, she said, still whisking and whisking. Except Larry was easy to live with. I love Coralie dearly, but that woman is Jesus bit clean through.
Her tone made it plain that this was not a compliment. She must have seen Marshall's surprise, because she added,
The Jesus that got his teeth in Coralie is not the Jesus I know. Even sterner than Larry's, truth be told, I felt sorry for Lexi. Coralie would put her braids in so tight you could see the hairs a-pullin' at her scalp, like to pop.
She shot him a mischievous glance.
And that right there, young man, is a metaphor.
It made Marshall chuckle, in spite of everything. Were you a teacher, ma'am?
No, she said. Unless you count Sunday school, I just like a book in the evenings.
Maybe someone else from your old church would have better contact information, Marshall prompted. Her mouth turned down.
Might be so, but I mostly went there for Larry. I've lost touch with those folks over the years.
Marshall was learning a lot, but not the right things. Nothing that told him where Lexi might be holed up now. Did Lexi have a close friend when she was a girl? Someone she might be with now? So far, my investigation indicates that she and her mother are not currently together.
Oh, no. I hope that doesn't mean she's back to her old ways.
She looked genuinely upset at the thought. He reassured her. I have no reason to believe she's fallen off the wagon. She turned back to her cocoa.
That's all right, then. No, Lexi didn't have friends growing up. Not like you mean. I was her friend.
Mariah was musing almost to herself now as she turned the stovetop off and poured the cocoa into two ceramic mugs, filling both perfectly.
She was homeschooled until after her daddy died and Coralie had to go to work. I don't mean in a co-op or group like they have now, just her and her mama. That child had no idea how to socialize by the time she got to real school. She was like one of those puppy mill dogs. She didn't know how to play.
He looked at her, very serious. So you were her friend, but you haven't heard from her directly, just her mother. She came over and passed him one of the mugs. His said, Today I need a whole lot of Christ, and then in tiny letters under, and a little bit of coffee. Hers was yellow and said, blessed, in curly script.
I meant I was her friend when she was little, she said, and sat down across from him. Please understand, I hadn't seen Coralie for years until she showed up here a few months back. I knew her at once, though she looked awful. She told me she'd just dropped Lexi off at a rehab, sold her house to get the money, which shocked me. It was not Lexi's first time through, you understand. But then she told me her own diagnosis. So I thought, well, why not sell the house? She hadn't much time.
The cocoa was creamy and rich, foamy from all the whisking. The real thing. No indication where she meant to go? No thoughts about where Lexi could be now?
No, I'm sorry. When Lexi went into treatment, Coralie stayed with me for a few days until it looked like Lexi would stick it out. Then she said she wanted to rent herself a place closer to the facility and visit every day. I told her she was welcome back any time, and Lexi too, she said. We'd taken them in before, you may know.
You mean the job at Funtime? He asked.
You have done your research. Yes, Lexi was such a cute little thing back then. I was taken with her. Hair like a buttercup, smile like sunshine. Larry and I never did have our own kids. It wasn't in the cards for us. So I spent time with Lexi. She was sweet and quiet and neat as a pin. Loved books.
I connected with her on that, but I felt bad she was so anxious about her grades. I think because her mother never was satisfied. If Lexi got an A, Coral Lee wondered why it wasn't an A+. Lexi liked things peaceful, and I'm the same. As a little 'un, she would wring her hands and cry when Coral Lee got mad.
Marshall nodded. This Lexi tracked with the girl Trey had described, confirming a corner of Trey's story. A small corner. Did she have any other friends at the church?
Not really. She'd go to Sunday school and sit quiet, listen to the lesson, make her craft. She didn't wiggle around or whisper. A dog mill puppy, like I said. It was why I started inviting her family up for Sunday lunch to give Lexi a little fun. Oh, she loved that carousel. Coral Lee can be a challenge, and Lexi's daddy was a stern man, too. But Preston was in construction just like Larry, and they had similar politics and church thoughts, so the boys had things to talk about. After a couple of years, a foreman job came up with Larry's outfit, and Larry helped Preston get it. 2 months later, he was dead. Freak accident. He fell at a job site and cracked his skull open. Before Larry got him hired on, he'd been working demo for years, which is so much more dangerous. Larry felt responsible, I think.
So he offered her a job. Not a question, just keeping her on track.
Not just the job, a place to live, so she could rent her house out for some income and keep homeschooling.
She finally took a sip of her drink. He'd already finished his.
Her husband had insurance, thank God, enough to pay off the mortgage, but she didn't want to stay there. Hard, you know, looking every day at all those places where she'd see the shape of her husband and him not there. I understood it after Larry died. I moved right in here. Then, a couple years later, I regretted it so. All I wanted was to see his places and shapes. She must have been the same, because after a year and change, she did get a full-time job and move home. Lexi was 11 or maybe 12 when she finally went to school.
He had a sense of something she wasn't saying, or that he hadn't understood. Something important. He leaned in. They were living with you? She laughed.
No, a single woman? Larry said we'd look like Mormons. We let her live on the property at fun time, in Larry's hidey hole.
He felt himself get very still. Hidey hole? You mean like a bomb shelter? She shook her head.
Not exactly. More like a cabin, but built back into the hill. It was for Armageddon.
She was so matter-of-fact, blinking at him with those dark, bright eyes. He leached all judgment from his voice, made his tone mild and interested. So Larry was a survivalist. She made a pish noise.
Oh, not really. Just our church preached a pretty immediate gospel. Now, mind, I wasn't fussed myself too much about Armageddon. Jesus himself said, but of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. So why do all that math? But the folks at Christ Redeemer thought it was soon. They were bracing for a world war and famine and disease and Satan ruling for 1,000 years of torment. They had a whole chart with Revelation matching up to politics and world events and whatnot. That's why we bought the property with the Funtime gold mine on it. Larry liked how it was up on a hill, out of all the main ways, with well water instead of being on a city system. Larry added the carousel, and he also built his hidey hole behind it. Kept it stocked with all these awful freeze-dried dinners in a bag he got at Army Surplus, and he put in a gas jenny and a compost toilet. He figured if things got bad, we could wait for the rapture there, snug as bugs. But of course the rapture didn't happen. That was what split the church, having the day come and go.
She shrugged.
Revelation is a tricky book.
Marshall's heart was pounding. He could feel it in his fingers, his ears. This got him no closer to Lexi, but it might not matter. Not if he was right. How far behind fun time?
His voice had a creak in it.
Misdirection, he was thinking. That was what Coralie Pine did best. Every cop hair on his body was standing straight up.
Half a mile, if that, back through the woods up a little trail that I bet by now is grown over. They built a new highway, so no one had to pass the road to Funtime to get up to Highlands anymore. The power and such was costing more than we made. We had to close it down. We put it up for sale, too, but no one ever bought it, so there it sits. I'm going to leave it to my sister's middle girl. She might could do something with it.
She was off again on another tangent, but Marshall let her go down it. His blood was singing in his veins as if it had been heated. Nothing, she said, would get him to Lexi. It didn't matter. They didn't need her. He thought. He was sure. He was almost sure. He knew where Robert was.
20. Marshall arrived an hour before sunrise. He'd gone home to shower, shave, and change. Trey and I did the same, putting on jeans and good walking shoes. Then I started a fresh pot of coffee, and I made us all eggs with fruit and toast. We needed fuel, whether or not any of us felt like eating. We sat at the breakfast table, dutifully putting food into our stomachs, and Marshall told us that he now believed Coralie was holed up at Funtime with Robert. That she'd been at Funtime since the second time she called me.
She knows the place. She feels safe there, and she understands, better than anyone, how completely isolated it is, Marshall said. He was tearing through the food. Plus, she's sick, so how much energy does she have to travel? Not to mention, Lexi's rehab must have close to wiped her out. Squatting there is free.
His new plan was simple. When I walked up to the carousel to meet her, Coral would have to leave Robert alone. I would distract her long enough for Marshall to sneak up the hill past us and find the hidey hole. He'd spent time learning the area on Google Earth and in his Maps app with the help of Mariah Denton.
That was challenging, he said, and his tone made it clear this was an understatement. She doesn't own a computer, never has, and she couldn't get her head around the idea that satellites are taking pictures of, well, everything. Wanted me to zoom in on her old house, then the Kroger.
He buried his face in his hands briefly.
Anyway, once I got her on task, she pretty much pinpointed it for me. I'll find Robert and evacuate him while you keep Coral busy. No, Trey said. I don't want Bree to meet her at all. That woman is insane. She could be armed. She could...
She has no interest in hurting me, I interrupted. She didn't. She wouldn't. I was a mother like her. I reminded her of her own child. I was the mother Lexi had never gotten to be. No, she wanted Trey. She'd take Robert. But not me. More important, he was arguing the wrong things. Marshall's plan was too easy and too reckless both. Robert can't be there, Marshall. She wouldn't hide him so close. Her whole leverage is that if I send the cops instead of bringing Trey to her, she'll kill herself and leave Robert to... I blinked back tears. If he's that close, the police would surely find him. I remembered Spencer, spasming and foaming, and I shuddered. She wouldn't bluff about this. She means him harm if I don't give her Trey.
Marshall swallowed the last of his toast. I agree, it's not a bluff. She's after blood.
He was remembering Spence, too, I thought.
the pills she'd convinced me were roofies.
But she knows this place intimately. With the bird's eye view she has, she can see the parking lot. I bet she can see the road, too, for miles, and it's the only way in. Maybe there's hiking trails, but she knows those, too. Meanwhile, she's told us she's leaving the baby elsewhere and driving to meet us. So if we, for example, send cops in early to set up an ambush, she's already there, watching them arrive. If she sees or hears anyone but you and Trey, she has plenty of time to...
His voice cut out abruptly. He didn't want to say what she would do, but he didn't have to. By the time the police made their way to the hidey hole, they would find only the bodies. Trey had gotten up while Marshall spoke. He was pacing, jittery from caffeine and sleeplessness and waiting.
You think she would leave Robert alone in that cabin when she comes to meet Bree? What if you get to the cabin and Lexi is there, armed with our kid?
I answered first. She won't have Lexi anywhere nearby, period. Not only because we could send the police and she wanted to keep Lexi's hands clean, of all the things she'd told me, that one had the most of my faith. But because she wouldn't ask Lexi to harm a baby. What Coral had done to Jeff had a ricochet. Coral had felt it. She wouldn't want her frail, newly sober child to do that. I knew it, deep in my own motherhood, so solid and strong that I'd bet Robert's life on it. Not that I had another choice. We spent our last hours chewing it over, the three of us, back and forth and around and around. Trey was mutinous. He hated the idea of me walking up alone to meet with her while he sat all the way down the hill in the car in relative safety. I didn't want Trey to come, period. I was afraid she'd kill him outright. But Marshall said she would have to be a Marine sharpshooter to pick Trey off from the top of the hill. But what if she got lucky? Or what if she saw us coming and walked down to the parking lot to meet us with a shotgun? Trey said there was no way in hell he was sitting home, though, and Marshall agreed. Coral needed to see Trey arrive. We had to look like we were complying. We argued about that until it was almost time to go, recycling the same points and fears and hopes without making any headway, churning fruitlessly. Marshall's plan won out. Marshall looked relieved and also a little sick. We were betting so much on his gut instinct. If he was wrong... Still, his gut instinct had gotten us this far. I couldn't see clearly past any moment where Marshall was wrong, so he wasn't wrong, and that was all. Our course was set. As we got up to leave, Trey said,
"We should take your car. It has the base of Robert's car seat."
I nodded, moved to near tears by his implication. Taking the car seat base was an act of such deliberate hope that it made me think of Kelly Wilkerson, with her past tense verbs, her bare walls, her empty indented carpet. Her son's small life was over, and he was already wiped entirely away. She seemed almost wiped away as well. Trey was saying I would not become like her, just a body too full of rage and drugs and grief to hold anything else. Trey was saying we were going to bring our son home. Marshall got in the back seat, and I put a stack of dark blankets, gray and navy, in beside him. Trey drove. Once we were on the highway, I reached over the gap between the seats to hold his hand. He gripped mine so tight it almost hurt. We didn't talk much on the drive. No need. We all knew the plan. It was crazy and thin and the only thing we had. There was little traffic leaving Atlanta this early on a Sunday morning. People were either still in bed or at church. My mother had skipped her own service to let the girls sleep in. She'd forgotten to tell them to put their phones away when she went to bed, and she thought they'd stayed up late. I texted with her a little bit, sending cheery missives about my recovery. She was hoping to keep them long enough for pancake brunch before I came to take them back. I told her that sounded perfect. Both girls slept until 11, sometimes noon on weekends. This would all be over before they had so much as stirred. Thinking of them, tucked up safe together in Mom's guest room, sleeping in the boneless way of young and growing things, made me long for them so fierce. I wanted to wake them myself and offer pancakes, smell their warm, sleepy skin, and pet their tousled hair back. Their absence felt both normal and insane. They often spent weekends with my mom or with Trey's parents, getting spoiled, while Trey and I ducked out to the Biltmore or up to New York. Now, though, I felt as if a month had passed since I'd seen them, as if I'd abandoned them while focused solely on their brother. I wanted to make it up to them, though they had no idea that there was something to make up. It would be better to keep it that way, if we could. If we got Robert back. If. I was so tired of that word. We made excellent time, getting so ahead of schedule that as we pulled off the interstate, I worried we'd arrive too early. I wanted to do everything exactly right. There was a cluster of stores and gas stations at this exit. Crystal, Chick-fil-A, Dollar General. I asked Trey to pull in at a gas station to use the bathroom and get coffee, but mostly to kill time. Trey didn't need the restroom. He stayed by the pumps, topping off my car. Marshall and I headed in. There was a young woman outside by the door. She leaned against the ice machine, smoking, though she looked way too young to buy cigarettes legally. She had lank brown hair and a rash of pimples on her forehead that her straggly bangs failed to hide. She straightened as we drew close. "Hey, ma'am," she said to me, only me, and her eyes twitched nervously toward Marshall. I understood why. He looked like a cop. And yet she was desperate enough to talk to me, and so I stopped. "Could you maybe get me something to eat?" "Sure," I said. She smiled, and I saw a large black cavity, oval-shaped, growing between her two front teeth. "What would you like?" Marshall cleared his throat, a neutral sound. I ignored it. She licked her chapped lips. "If you gave me a little money, I could pick. They'll let me come inside if I can show them I have money."
"We'll get you a sandwich," Marshall said, and instantly her eyes dropped and she stepped back. He took my arm and I let him tote me inside. When the swinging glass door had swished closed behind us, he told me, "If you give her money, she'll just buy drugs."
"Oh, you think?" I said, tart. I took my arm back and went to the bathroom. When I got out, Marshall was already paying for our coffee by the register. I went to the refrigerated case, looking for soft things because of her teeth. I didn't see anything I'd want to feed my girls, not for a meal. In the end, I picked out two different kinds of Lunchables, a carton of milk, and a bottle of orange juice. I headed for the register, passing through the snack aisle to add a plain Hershey's chocolate bar and a four-pack of Dole fruit cups, so old they had a fine layer of dust on the cardboard shell. The date stamp said they were still good, though. When I handed her the bag, she smiled at the weight of it, showing me again the oval of rot between her front teeth. It was striated like an agate, a darkness that deepened in concentric circles, telling me there was a lack of money or a lack of love or both in this child's life.
"Thank you," she said.
Marshall started forward, but I didn't. Trey was back in the driver's seat, the engine running, but we were still ahead of schedule. This girl, she could have been Lexi 30 years ago. She was only 3 or 4 years older than Anna Claire. "Do you have some place to sleep tonight?" I asked, and Marshall stopped, waiting for me.
She shook her head. I could get a bed at the shelter, I know, if I had $12.
She looked at me, hopeful and guarded, pressing her lips together. I opened my wallet and pulled out all the cash I had, 7 or 8 bills. I had no idea how much. I handed it to her, and it felt like some kind of offering. She was an altar. I wished I had more. I could feel all the things that Marshall wasn't saying, but he held his peace.
Thank you, she said again, blinking very fast.
The money disappeared into her pocket quickly, as if she was afraid I'd change my mind. Take care of yourself, I told her. We got back into the car. Trey seemed about to say something, but he got one look at my face and put us in drive and headed out. I grabbed his hand again. With every passing mile, I could feel us getting closer to Coral Lee Pine. I could feel her waiting. Our strange connection crackled, as slim as a filament, but strong and live with current. I wondered if she sensed me coming as well, catching the ozone smell of our shared electricity rising in the wind. The roads were old, and the closer we got, the worse they became. My SUV shuddered and jolted over the pitted ash-gray asphalt. My cell phone lost its signal. 10 minutes out, Marshall opened his seatbelt and lay down across the floorboards. Trey was driving, so I unclipped mine as well and leaned between the seats to help cover him with the blankets. The Escalade had a flat floor with a good amount of legroom, but long, tall Marshall still had to lie half on his back, half on his side, his knees at an awkward angle. As I layered the blankets over his body, making sure his feet were covered, I felt as if I were tucking him in. His eyes met mine, determined, encouraging. I touched his cheek and nodded, though he hadn't said a thing. I pulled the covers over his face. If all went well, Coral would be up the hill, on the grounds of Funtime itself. From her perch, she'd be able to see us arrive. She would not come down, Marshall had assured me over and over. It would be bad tactics to give up the high ground before making sure Trey and I really had come alone with no police. But did old ladies think like cops in terms of tactics? The sparse woods grew thicker as the hills grew steeper. There was still a faded sign standing at the turnoff. It featured a tall, cowboy-shaped human figure wielding a lasso. His features and body were covered in graffiti almost as old and faded as the sign itself. I could see that the coils of his rope spelled out Fun Time, but only because I already knew the place's name. A mile past the sign, another directed us left into the parking lot. It was empty except for an ancient Honda, the white paint coated in filth, and the back bumper crumpled in and rusted. Trey crept toward it, avoiding the largest potholes. He looked pale as he parked beside it, just left of the wide concrete double staircase. "You ready?" I asked the heap of blankets. I heard a muffled yes. I got my phone out and put it on vibrate, then opened up my stopwatch app and set it for 7 minutes. The blankets tinted and shifted as Marshall did the same. When the timer went off, I would have 30 seconds to make sure Coral was not watching the lot so Marshall could slip out of the car unseen and get into the cover of the woods. If Coral Lee spotted him, she'd hurry back to the hidey hole and get to Robert first. If she was armed, I might not be able to stop her. Trey said, "I still don't like you going up there alone." "She probably expects me to come up first." I sounded sure, because I was. I could feel her above us, watching, wanting to talk to me again. The strange thing was, I wanted it too. I was almost hungry for it, this chance to clearly see the face that went with the voice I knew so well. I wanted her to look right at me, too, and really see me. I wanted the chance to change her mind.
Just stay here. Bree, my husband said. But this was the plan. 1, 2, 3, I said to the heap of blankets, then hit the timer on my phone. Got it, Marshall said. The numbers began counting down. I slid the phone into my back pocket to muffle the vibration. Bree, Trey said again. Our eyes met. The world could change in so many different awful ways in the next hour. I was conscious of Marshall lying prone on the floor and the tick of each second. I leaned over to press my mouth against my husband's hard and fast. Trust me, I said. I could feel how tough it was for him to let me get out of the car, close the door, and leave him there. But he did it. I hurried toward the entrance. I had just shy of 7 minutes. The concrete stairs were wide and steep, with 4 metal railings breaking them into 3 sections. I went straight up the middle, fast and steady. As I ascended, I thought, get into character. But who was this person climbing up to see Coralie Pine? Betsy's black visa could not help me here. I could almost feel it fall away. So many things were falling away. For this meeting, our first, our last, I had to be a mother like her, a woman from small town Georgia, like Lexi, the only daughter of a hard scrabble single mom. This was the person who might move her to relent. Going up, it did not feel like I was putting on a role. It felt like being peeled. I shrugged off anything that wouldn't help me. The corporate wife with her closet full of $1,000 dresses. The stay-at-home mom with a cleaning lady and the luxury of no job beyond her family, able to help at every rehearsal and robotics meet. The wealthy woman on the board of 2 prominent nonprofits. Even the young, pretty Bree who'd gone strolling through the High Museum so confident, catching Trey's eye in her expensive borrowed sundress. It all fell away until I felt like little more than a child. I was a girl who'd never had dialect classes to sand her accent away. I could feel my mouth resetting itself for extended vowels and dropped G's. I was Betsy's friend, tearing down the pitted, pale gray asphalt of our street on a hand-me-down big wheel. I was Shelly Ann Kroger's daughter, making tuna casserole with crumbled potato chips on top after school because my mom worked 2 jobs and she would come home so tired and hungry. This was where we had connected, Coral and I, and it wasn't a character. It was only me. My most basic beginning self. The steep stairs shortened my breath. Above me, a huge blue cowboy hat appeared over the crest of the hill. As I hurried up, the rest of Funtime Jack rose, his face splotched black with mold that turned his wide smile into a threat. His blue pack mule stood beside him, one eye a fuzzy black pit. The end of its round nose had fallen off. The ticket booth came into view last. It had rotted in on itself, deflating into a pile of wood and shingles and signage. At the top, a path snaked between Jack and its remains, leading to the carousel. I had to stop for a moment to catch my breath. Most of the animals and poles were gone, I saw. On the far side, the roof had fallen, so it was almost like a cave. I peered into the shadowy recesses, and there she was, Coralie Pine, who owned that whispery voice I'd learned so well. She sat on one of the bench seats for tired parents. It was loose from the base, canted to face the stairs. I could not make out her features in the shadows. I walked forward, conscious of the phone in my pocket, the seconds ticking away. How long had the climb taken? 4 minutes? Less? The bench's sides were carved into the shape of a stampede of horses,
They faced me, too. Their mouths yawped open, and their eyes were wide. As I got close, I saw they were actually unicorns, with faded wreaths of roses around their necks and short spiral horns. One of the rideable animals, a lion, was lying on his side to Coralie's left. The pole was still attached, so it looked as if he'd been run through. He had carved roses in a wreath around his neck, too, but the paint had faded and peeled away until the blooms looked like odd, spongy growths. I was at the edge of the platform now. I stepped up, finally close enough to see her deep-set eyes. Here was the face I'd first seen peering through my bedroom window, with that pointed chin, the turned-down mouth. Here also was the meemaw of the school's parking lot, wearing the same dark-knit cap with its small peak. Her long hair straggled down her shoulders in thin, silvery ropes. She was no older than my mother-in-law, but she had not had Margaret Cabot's regimen of moisturizers and doctors to roll back time. The years sat heavy on her. She was pale, and a sheen of sweat had broken on her brow. Her eyes met mine, wide and anxious, and too intense for me to hold the gaze. Just to her right, she'd placed a small card table. It was set for tea, with a woven mat, a flowered china pot, and two matching cups on pink-flowered saucers, the delicate handles edged in gold. They were full of dark liquid, and all at once, I could not swallow. The brimming cups were harder to look at than she was. Her baggy, shapeless dress was ash-colored. She had a brown and orange afghan on her lap, hand-crocheted by the look of it. The folds of it pooled on the bench beside her. One hand was hidden under the blanket. Holding a gun? I had no way to tell. But that possibility did not make me nearly as anxious as those delicate cups or the intensity in her hooded eyes.
"Hello, Mrs. Cabot," she said, quite formal.
The voice from the phone. It made my jaw tighten, but also pulled me one step closer. We knew each other, she and I. She gestured toward the path behind me.
"That's your husband in the driver's seat down there."
I nodded, glancing back. The stairs were too steep for her to have watched my ascent, but I could see the lot and the cars and the gray road snaking away through the hills and trees. Trey was a shadowy shape in the driver's seat.
"He needs to come up now."
"In a little. I told him I'd wave when it was time." Sabrina Kroger's voice, shaky and unconfident, southern, shy. I hadn't been this girl in 2 decades, but I wasn't acting. This was a true creature, pulled out from the deepest places inside the woman I'd grown into. This was the girl Coralie Pine felt for, connected with. At the same time, I was Robert's mother, here to fight her tooth and claw. I could hold both. I knew I could. It was the most important thing the theater had ever taught me. "I wanted to talk to you first. Just us."
"I thought you might. Please, pull up a seat."
There was another bench sitting aslant nearby. I came closer and sat down on it.
"I'd offer you tea, but..."
She smiled for the first time, wide, almost a grimace. I was shocked by all the dark gaps in her mouth. So many of her teeth were gone. She gestured at the china cups.
"This is not for you."
I felt my skin trying to shudder itself off my body. "I know. It's for Trey. And you." She dipped her chin in a small acknowledgement.
Is it the same drug I gave Spencer?
She nodded, and I made myself meet her gaze as I told her,
It's not a good way to go.
She shrugged.
I used a lot. It will be faster. It will be very, very fast.
She picked up the cup closer to her, considering its dark contents.
Call Mr. Cabot up now, please. He can have his tea and we'll wait a little. Then I tell you where to find your boy and have a drink myself.
Time felt as if it were moving so slowly, too slowly. I wondered if my timer had somehow turned itself off in my pocket. Surely 7 minutes had passed.
I want to talk to you first.
She shrugged.
You don't have much time.
She lifted her cup to me in a mock toast, as if readying to drink it, tray or no tray. I felt a chill of doubt in my spine. Marshall had convinced me that Robert was here. But if so, if she killed herself now, we would find him easily. She would never allow that. I knew it. Was Marshall wrong? I opened my mouth to speak, and in my back pocket, I finally felt the gentle buzz of the phone. In 30 seconds, Marshall would be sprinting for the woods. If he was right, he'd find Robert snug in his little car seat. He would go in, get him, and take him down to Trey. Trey would drive the baby out of reach of any gunfire, and Marshall would come up the stairs to get me, armed, dangerous, ready. But first, Marshall had to get out of her field of vision to the shelter of the trees, unseen. I stood abruptly, staring at the spine of the carousel behind her.
Is someone else here?
I asked, my voice sharpening.
No, she said, alarmed. Not unless you brung them.
She still held her tea, but her other hand moved under the afghan. I hurried past her bench, heading to the hollow center spine of the carousel. The boards sagged under my steps, creaking audibly. She turned to track me, now facing away from the lot.
Be careful, she said. He could bring the rest of the roof down.
I ignored her, going directly to the carousel house. The door panel had been ripped away. Inside, I could see the remains of all its workings. It was a dank and musty space, cold and dark, like a cave inside a cave, dead empty. I looked back at her, shrugging.
I think it was settling, or maybe a rat?
Are there rats? She was still twisted around, peering into the darkness with me. I walked toward her so she couldn't face the road without giving me her back. Her shoulders stiffened, and she set her tea down, turning as far as she could to watch me approach. Her free hand came up to rest on the bench's back. It was old and gnarled, twisted by arthritis. I reached out very slowly so as not to startle her, and I put my hand on top of hers. Her skin was cool and dry and papery. I felt such a strange tenderness for her as our hands touched. I could not explain it, but I saw in her eyes my same feelings reflected. My touch had opened up a well of small regret inside her. Maybe even mercy? I came to beg, I said. I knelt, my hand still on hers. I looked up into her face, and I could smell her now. Baby powder layered over the sour smell of a person who had not washed thoroughly in days. Marshall must be right. In the Denton's hidey hole, she'd be using baby wipes or a basin of water warmed on the stove. Her hair, this close, was thick with grease. Her eyes were not black after all. They were a dark, deep brown, flecked with gold. The whites around them were yellowed, veined in red. She had an old woman's downy mustache. I could see how sick she was in her pallor, feel that her hand had a shake in it. I said, "I came to beg you for my baby." She looked down at me, thinking, I hoped, considering, her gaze full of a thousand things, but one of them was close to Mercy. I could see it. Finally, she said,
"You're so pretty up close, real pretty. Taller than I thought, too."
"I want my son," I said. "And what you're asking me to trade is impossible. You're punishing me more than any other person, me and Jeff's mother. What did we do?"
She glanced at her watch, a utilitarian thing, digital, then shook her head, her eyes on me, so tender.
"We do not have the time it would take me to explain. This is going to finish in my next 100 breaths, one way or another. Still, I want you to know, I thought about what you said to me, about how this path I had to take was so hard on you and Jeff's mother as well. Did your husband tell you what he'd done?"
I blinked, unsure how to answer. "He told me a little," I said at last, "but..."
I had no excuses for him, no way to finish.
"I thought as much. Anything he said, I'm sure he made it soft for you. So yesterday, I wrote some things, hard, true things. An explanation, if you will. Then I drove down to the post office. When you get my letter, you'll understand what's happened here and why. You'll know who Jeff's mother is then. I added her name and address. Maybe the two of you ought to talk. You maybe can help each other cope."
My breath caught. "You mailed me a letter?"
I tried to imagine seeing Kelly Wilkerson again, reading Coral's twisted version of the ugly story Trey had told me.
"Yes, it's the best I can do. Now, for your boy's sake, call your husband up. It's time."
Surely Marshall was safely out of view by now. Still, I knelt, holding her gaze. "The best thing you could do is stop this. Tell me where my son is."
This soft woman, begging like a child, this was true and truly me. At the same time, I spoke slowly, buying Marshall precious seconds. She made that short, small hum noise that I knew so well. Her eyes on me stayed kind.
"You remind me of my own girl. Not that you look like her, but you're so smart and pretty, and I think you have a sweet heart."
She swallowed audibly and blinked hard, clearly in the grip of some deep feeling.
"You're the woman I hoped she'd grow to be when I sent her off to college. Maybe that surprises you, that a woman like me would have a girl who went to college. But she did."
"I did too," I said, soft, drawing another line between me and Lexi.
She didn't seem to hear me, though.
"Even when she is little, she is so booky and so smart. She applied for every scholarship you ever heard of, and she got a slew of them. So many people, her teachers, our pastor, they wrote letters like you wouldn't believe on her behalf. Such a bright future, all those letters said."
Her gold brown eyes were so tender and so sad, but her next words came out harder. It didn't work out that way. Not for her. Not like it did for you.
She started to turn away, and I clutched her hand with both of mine, almost tugging.
I did nothing to you.
I know, but the world ain't fair, Mrs. Cabot. I sent my girl off in good faith, and your husband and his friends ruined her. They stole away every bright future that my family might have had.
I had misread her softness. It wasn't mercy. It was more like regret, as if her plan had already played out to the finish. I understood then. There was no changing her. Everything was over already in her mind, done. This was just us working out a last small detail. Trey or Robert? I let go of her hand and stood, looking past her, down into the lot. All I saw was the SUV, all doors closed, Trey in the driver's seat. Surely Marshall was almost to Robert. I had to hold her attention a little longer. If he was right, if all went well, in 5 or 6 more minutes, maybe less, my son would be safe in his arms. That word haunting me again. It was too much hope and terror for 2 letters to hold. If.
21. Marshall ran, quick and quiet, angling up through the thin trees at the base of the hill. His heart was pounding, but not from the run. He had missed something. Something wasn't right. He could almost feel his wife moving with him through the trees. Betsy's ghost, who just after her death had come to haunt him every shift, reminding him, "You have a kid. You have our kid. You have no backup." It was the reason he'd changed jobs. Strange to feel her presence now, so close he could almost smell her jasmine lotion. The crazy corkscrews of her hair were in the breeze that touched his face as he ran. But he was not in danger. Bree was. Bree, alone with Coral Lee Pine. That was probably what was bothering him. He glanced at his phone. Bree and Trey had both lost signal, but his shittier carrier somehow still had a faint connection. He was navigating with the map on his phone and some still shots he'd taken off Google Earth. All aerial views, looking down on his location from space. It had been fall the last time the satellite passed over. The pictures made this place look lonely and cold, with brownish red clay the only warmth threading through the dark granite and the thick cover of the turning leaves. Today, though, was all sunlight filtered through the vivid green. There was bird song, and to his left, something small, a squirrel or a rabbit, dashed away. Down here, it was a beautiful spring day. And he had missed something. He knew it. He'd made a mistake. But what? He ran as lightly as he could, avoiding twigs that might snap and the low leafy branches that might rustle. If Coral Lee heard him, if she realized what they were doing, she might decide it was better to take Trey's wife away from him than take nothing. That must be why he felt Betsy brushing through him as he hurried up and up the hill so steep that he was already a little winded. But they'd known this risk going in. Bree believed that Coral would not hurt her, and if she was wrong, she didn't care. All she wanted was for him to find the baby, get Robert out safe. That was his only job. He was skirting close to Funtime, but the woods were thick and well-shaded, widespread branches reaching for the sun in competition with one another. That would make him harder to see. Plus, it meant that there was not a lot of ground cover. The time he was saving felt worth the risk. He caught a flash of electric blue through the trees far off to his right. Funtime Jack's hat.
He was already flanking the entrance. The carousel was just beyond. Was he too close? He had on his good hiking boots and dark jeans with a green patterned shirt he hoped might blend with the woods. Now he must stay fast and yet be so quiet. He said it over and over to himself like a mantra, fast and quiet, fast and quiet. The top edge of the carousel's collapsed roof came into view. He angled out, though he was too far to clearly see Bree or Coral. If they were talking, he could not hear their voices, and this was good. He hoped to God this meant that they could not see or hear him. Then he was past the carousel roofline, heading northwest on an angle farther up the slope. If this was not officially the Blue Ridge Mountains yet, it was damn close. It was plenty hilly here. His breath came short. There was no fence around Fun Time proper. He had to guess how far he needed to go to get around the old gold panning site. In aerial pictures, it had been two matched squares of dirt, wood-framed, behind the carousel. Gold mine attractions like these were often nothing but large planting boxes full of sandy earth. He and Betts had taken Kara to one up near Dahlonega when she was little. The owners seeded the loose soil with souvenir nuggets and let kids pan until they got something. The pits did not take up a lot of room. He must be past them now. He angled back the other way, skirting the back edge of Funtime. According to Mrs. Denton, there had once been a path leading directly from the gold mine to the hidey hole. He scanned for gaps in the trees that felt deliberate. But the woods were thinner here. Any of the spaces through the trees could be parts of a former path. He turned back up the slope and pressed on, no longer running. Now he was searching. There should be a cleared space up nearby, the remains of the Dentons' old garden. Past that was the hidey hole, which might be hard to see. He hadn't been able to see it at all on Google Earth. He felt that it was close. He also felt his unease rising, the smell of danger. He'd missed something. He was so tired. He felt that he'd aged years, as if the last 2 days had been a shortcut straight to middle age. The earth was red with clay, the spring leaves and needles shading everything. He pulled himself up a small, steep incline. It leveled off into a shelf, and when he stood, he found himself in the open. The garden. It was on a rare level place, the hill rising up again behind it. Over half of it was still skirted by the remains of a low rail fence. Some rails were missing. Other sections had been pulled over or coated by blackberry vines. Just to his left, a rusty gleam of silver caught his eye, an old bale of chicken wire lying on its side. His heart was pounding. The hidey hole must be very, very close. He started across. The sun hit this cleared space directly, so bushes and wildflowers and vines had taken hold. Blackberry and wild rose thorns snagged at his pants as he pushed through. On the far side, an improbable stand of bright sunflowers towered, off-season, tall and crazy. He scanned the hill ahead, and a flash of light pulled his attention. The gleam of heavy glass shining through the trees. A window. The Denton's hidey hole was right in front of him. He'd practically been looking at it, but only now did the shapes resolve. There was a weathered wall of gray siding built into the hillside. The cabin was narrow and tucked under a rocky overhang in shadow. It had a heavy door and a single window. It had been built to blend, and as Mrs. Denton had said, the bulk of the house had been dug out from the hill itself. His heart thumped hard, a booming in his chest. If he was right about anything, then it was this. Robert was here. Robert was 50 feet away on the other side of that ancient wooden door. He knew it. He felt it. So why did he hesitate? She wouldn't bluff about this. She means him harm, Bree had said. He felt Betsy's fingers brush the back of his neck in warning, making the small hairs rise. Was someone with Robert after all? Lexi? He unholstered his .38 and crept parallel to the cabin, moving out of the view from that single filthy window. Then he started forward again, angling his path to approach from the side. He felt stupid doing it. Lexi wasn't up here. Coral, who read mysteries and thrillers, would not let Lexi deposit forensic evidence at the scene of a kidnapping. Still, he felt watched. Still, he kept sneaking gingerly toward the window from the side, silent. If Robert was not alone, then it had to be Lexi. Who else would love Coral Lee Pine enough to help her steal a baby? Engineer Spence's death. Coldly murder a toddler. There wasn't anybody else. If he looked through the window and saw Lexi holding the baby, he would have to make a choice. He could put a bullet in her eye, then kick the door down and dig the baby out from underneath her body. Or he could hope she would not have her mother's ruthlessness and kick the door down first, commanding her to put her hands up, away from Robert's frail, small neck. He stepped soft along the wall, crouching, and then peeped up through the window. There was only sunlight to brighten the dim room, and this single window's glass was dirty, but the first thing he saw was the shape of the car seat with the small form blanketed snugly inside it. Robert, alive, not unhappy. He was stirring from a nap, yawning and stretching, bowing his small spine, eyes shut. Lexi was not there. The second thing Marshall saw answered all his questions. Who else would help Coral take such a dark revenge? No one but Lexi's own father, who was dead, who had long been dead. And yet, his hand was at work here, too. My husband had a good job in construction, Coral had told Bree. She'd been around the sites, taking him his lunch each day. Mariah Denton had said he worked demo for years. Marshall had filed that information away. He had not applied it. The dynamite piled around the car seat was old. Very old. So old it was sweating, and the papery layers had begun peeling away. It must be unstable as all hell, and there was a lot of it stacked in a horseshoe around the baby. Almost too scared to move, Marshall sucked in a shallow breath. He didn't know shit about explosives. He wondered how much Coral knew. He didn't see an obvious, sleek black box with helpful numbers counting down in bright digital red. Instead, he saw wires or cables, or perhaps twisted fuses, running in lines over and around the heaped dynamite. Robert's eyes were open now. He kicked one of his feet out from under the blanket, waving it around. The movement brought his puppy-covered sock quite near the old, sweating explosives. Marshall's mouth went dry. He shielded his eyes with his hands, peering in, trying to make out details. The cabin was one room with a poured concrete floor. There was a large camp stove next to a couple of folding chairs and a square table, plus a large, deep metal sink, like the kind in his laundry room. An ancient double bed sagged by the back wall, flanked by a sizable storage cabinet on one side and what looked like a chest freezer on the other. That was all. His gaze was pulled inexorably back to the explosives, his mouth too dry for him to swallow. One of the thick wires or cables ran in a looping coil that disappeared around the back of the pile of dynamite closest to Robert's head. What was at the end of that?
A timer? A detonator? The baby was looking around now, awake, waving his limbs bare inches from the ancient sweating stacks. It could all blow any second. If he were dumb enough to kick the door down, it would blow for sure. Even breaking out this window was a huge risk, Jesus. At the other end of the state, his daughter was packing up her things, getting in the car. He wanted to be there when she got home. You have a kid. You have our kid. You have no backup. And yet that was such bullshit. He knew his wife. The ghost he felt was nothing but his nerves. If Betts were really here, his bold and mighty wife, she would damn well go in there and get Bree's boy. He said a quick and silent prayer, then stood up straight, reaching for the glass. 22. I begged. I kept begging, long after I knew it would do no good. She was unshiftable. But still, I wept and groveled, trying to buy Marshall enough time to find the hidden cabin. It was a one-note role for me. It was Coral who changed as I pleaded and cried. She grew sadder and softer and more at peace. Almost relaxed or fatalistic. Her sweaty sheen had gone. I begged until she held up her hand, silencing me. You aren't going to call him up. I understand. Deep down in you, you must know that he won't come. He won't walk up those steps and do what must be done. Her voice was gentle, gentle with me, but I could hear scorn for Trey in her tone. With a wild flash of hope, I thought, maybe this is a test. If Trey comes up to face her, maybe that will be enough. Or he'll have to actually drink the cup to prove his courage, his goodness. It will turn out to be only English breakfast, brewed strong and black and scary. But I did not believe it. I was not in the after-school special version of revenge, here to learn a valuable lesson and then go home with my son and my husband to live a more virtuous life. I'd woken up in the world my mother had always believed in, where strangers had the worst intentions and disaster crouched a breath away, waiting for me to blink. Only 2 days had passed since I'd watched Spencer redden and heave and spew bloody foam onto the grass. This woman had engineered that death. She was genuinely sorry she hadn't been there to see him buck and die in agony. This was a woman who had spoken with simple, sad authority about the difficulties of pushing a 3-year-old under the water and holding him there. I argued anyway, feeling each good second I was buying creep past. You don't know him. He will come. If I go to the edge and wave, he'll come right up. She shook her head, then glanced at her watch again. You're a good mother. You'd trade yourself for your child just like I would. You walked up those stairs already. But now, you're out of time. You should call Mr. Cabot anyway, though, just so you know the truth. It would be good for you, moving forward, to know. I want you to see him cowering in that car. Or maybe he'll try. He might even get partway up the steps, dragging his feet. Before this is over, you should know for sure what you married, so you can choose better next time. You have your girls to think about. She had said a lot of things, but only one phrase truly landed for me. What do you mean I'm out of time? She ignored the question, barely pausing to let me finish it,
Or go ahead on down to your husband now. Take him home, if you find you still want him.
She tilted her head to gaze at me with a horrifying pity. As if Robert were already gone.
If you don't mind a little advice from one mother to another, get your girls away from him. My letter will come. You'll see then. When you do, I hope you'll get them away.
I took a step back toward the stairs.
I'll call him up. He'll come. You'll see. He'll trade himself. You don't know him.
It's too late, she said. The time has passed, and I have no desire to look into his face. I'll see him in hell eventually. I'll go on ahead and start my wait for him there.
I want you to know,
her voice hitched.
I'm truly sorry for your loss.
How can time...
And then my voice cut out, because she lifted the closer cup to her lips and drank it off in four long swallows. She set the cup down, flinching and shaking her head at the taste.
So bitter.
Her eyes were dark pits.
My God, what did you do?
I asked. How long had it taken before Spencer was sick and convulsing and dead? 15 or 20 minutes? But his dose had been in capsules. This was pure liquid. Coral cleared her throat. Her cheeks had already pinked. She smiled a soft, sad smile.
What did you do?
I asked again. That was when the explosion came, a huge, reverberating boom, as if God were answering my question. Orange light flashed around the edges of the carousel. The frame shook and rattled. I felt as if a giant hand had reached into my body and grabbed my spine to shake me, too. The old roof groaned and metal squealed. My hands flew up stupidly to cover my head as I cowered on the bench, sure the roof would come down on us. The china cups rattled on their saucers, dark liquid sloshing up over the rim of the full one, the one that had been meant for Trey. The heaving earth beneath us stilled. The roof had held. I sat on my bench, blinking in the sudden silence. There had been birdsong all around us, but I had not realized it until they went so quiet. I could not understand. I looked to Coral, and her face had changed. The Afghan had fallen to the floor, and I saw that her hidden hand clutched a small black metal box. Sorrow and ecstasy were at war across her features. Her nostrils flared. Her skin was very red now. She coughed.
It's done,
she rasped, so voiceless that I read the words off her lips more than I heard them.
God, it hurts. It hurts me.
She tipped forward then, landing on her knees in front of her bench, a strangling sound coming from her mouth. I stood up, blinking, stupid as a cow. I don't understand. My voice sounded trapped inside my head. I didn't want to understand. Robert, I didn't want to understand. I heard Trey's voice, tinny and faint, screaming my name from very far away. I looked down the hill. He was out of the car, his face a featureless white disc turned up toward us. Coral was heaving now, writhing and gurgling, her skin reddening in a frightening crimson blush. Then, I was running, without knowing or remembering when my feet had started moving. I banged into the stampeding unicorns on the arm of another of the heavy wooden benches, and sharp pain bit into my thigh and hip. I shoved myself away and kept on going, leaping off the platform, sprinting around the edge of the carousel. A plume of gray smoke was pillaring up into the blue, blue sky high above the trees.
I ran around the carousel and toward it, through what used to be the gold mine, my feet sinking in mounds of still soft earth that filled the framed boxes. I could see an orange glare growing up and ahead of me. I reached the woods, and I realized I was screaming. It was a word, this scream. The word was Robert. And this made no sense. I didn't want it to make sense. I could not stop screaming for him, stumbling up a steep slope through the trees, screaming in the wake of that, screaming into the stink of chemical-burned smoke rising in front of me, a black column marking an altar. I pulled myself up onto a flat, cleared space, and ahead of me, way on the other side of a small open field, I saw the smoking remains of a hole in the rock wall. There were bits of wood and twisted metal scattered about, and a few small fires burned inside and around it. Ash drifted down in flakes and specks. I leaped forward, running toward it, as if there were still a reason to run toward it. As if I might find him there, pink and sweet and fat and gurgling, unharmed in all that wreckage. Thorns grabbed at me, trying to slow me, and I ripped through them. My feet tangled in a low rail fence. I went sprawling into brambles and sun-warmed earth. I could barely breathe. There could be nothing living in that smoking, blackened cave. I knew that. I couldn't make myself not know. I felt blackness rushing through me, coming for me somehow, though its root was in me. It was coming. I could not stop it. I said, "Robert, Robert," quietly, into the dirt. That was when I heard him. A thin, uncertain wail. I knew his voice, upset and singular and uncertain and perfect. I felt the sharp pain in my breasts, and then a release, as if the milk from all the weeks I hadn't nursed him had let down at once. I rose up on my knees, looking all around. Behind me, Marshall was coming over the rise, red-faced and breathless, with the car seat in his arms. He ran across the thorny field toward me. He must already have been on the way down to Trey when the blast hit. He must have heard me screaming. I got up, ignoring the thorns that were ripping at my clothes and my skin, and I ran toward them. I got to them and grabbed them, both of them, hauling them to me, the car seat banging hard into my chest between us. Marshall grabbed me, too, holding my arms as I clutched the seat and stared down into Robert's dear, red, angry face, his eyes now screwing up, his mouth opening in a perfect, furious circle, his volume building. I dropped to my knees, and they came with me to the ground. I had never loved anything more on this earth than I loved the tiny life we held between us. The car seat's base touched the dirt, and I bent over it, hands scrabbling to unlatch him, to feel him all over, making sure he was moving and whole and unburned and unhurt and exactly himself. And he was. I pulled him out and held the dense, warm weight of him against my chest. His whole body was a clenched fist now. He screamed in my ear, and I loved his living, perfect fury. My eyes met Marshall's, and he was looking back, whispering over and over, "I got him, I got him." I drew Marshall to me, his dear face, and I pressed my mouth against his forehead, his ear, his hair. "You got him," I said back. To our right, a little patch of fire had caught in a dead rose bush. It glowed orange, growing, and smoke rose, and Robert yelled and squirmed in my arms. Now I could feel where the thorns had torn my skin. My hip pulsed pain from where I'd slammed into the bench. I understood that I was still in Coral's world. I might live here forever, from now on. In this fear-soaked place, my mother had always known existed.
She'd tried to tell me. She'd tried, but I refused to listen. Robert's tiny heartbeat fluttered against my own, his breath and tears hot against my neck. So even now, even knowing she had always seen things right, I could not care. My husband was calling my name from far away, below us.
"Up here," I called back. "We got Robert. We're up here."
"We got Robert," Marshall echoed, and his eyes were an animal's eyes, wild and wide. Somewhere, watching close or waiting far, Lexi Pine still walked. She was an enigma, who might be as angry and as dangerous as her mother, or just something small and broken, wanting only to return to the deadly balm of her addiction. But in this moment, my heart was so full, I could not spare the room to fear or pity her, not in any incarnation. Nearby, so close we felt the heat of it, the rose bush burned, and flakes of gray ash drifted down on us, gentle as snow. Marshall and I clung to each other, Robert between us, calling loud so Trey could find us, "We got him! We got him!" At the same time, we were saying it most truly to each other, back and forth, his arms tight around me with Robert, perfectly angry and alive, held safe and whole between us. Part 3. Daughters. 23. Outside my walls, in the dangerous world, Coral's letter was moving through the postal system. It passed from hand to hand, being sorted and loaded and carried ever closer as 3 slow days crawled past. In the aftermath of our meeting, I didn't think much about the paper words she'd aimed at me. She'd left a legacy that was far more dangerous. Lexi. I could feel her making her way closer, too. Lexi was a broad-spectrum anxiety, a darkness stretched so wide on my horizon that I could not see how my family would ever find our way through to normal. I wanted her arrested for her part in Jeff's death, but she knew I'd given Spence her mother's poison. I truly believed that Coral was his murderer, but I couldn't deny that I'd been her instrument. I had obeyed her every command. If Lexi were found, she would tell the police. Everyone would know. My children, my mother, all our friends and Trey's colleagues. I might go to prison. Having her loose in the world was worse, though. On Monday, the story hit the news, so Lexi must now know that her mother's plan was incomplete. In the darkest hours of the night, I wondered if Coral were also watching. Did she know she'd failed? Did her daughter feel her distant rage like arrows slivering through space and time to find her heart? As of Wednesday morning, the story had stayed local, nothing national. A political sex scandal and the murder contract a Buckhead housewife had put out on her cheating husband had more traction, or so Trey told me. I couldn't bear to watch any of it. The early reports were calling it a thwarted kidnapping, with no mention of revenge or Lexi or even the Wilkerson family. The press had not made those connections yet, though they still might when Lexi was caught, or when Jeff's body was found, or when the police released the information that Coral Lee Pine was also implicated in the murder of Spencer Shaw. They knew that because I'd told them so myself. That day, in the wake of the explosion, I huddled on the smoky hillside with Marshall, my son cradled so close.
In that moment, I could not believe that Coral was truly dead. Back at the carousel, I'd seen her drink, seen her drop to her knees, seen her face model and flush just like Spencer's at the party, but I had not seen her die. I kept thinking she was still alive when I left her. Even as Trey found a way up the hill to us, red-faced and panting. He fell to his knees beside me, saying, "Thank God, thank God," and running his hands over Robert's soft, bald head, then down his spine, then feeling every limb, just as I had. When he found no injuries, his short breaths changed to great, heaving gulps. He rocked back on his hips, still holding us. I had no bottle, no binky to offer angry Robert, so I gave him the tip of my finger to suck. I hummed and bounced him, leaning against my husband's broad chest. I could feel the pounding of Trey's heart quieting and easing. I don't know how long the three of us stayed that way, relearning how to breathe in the sweetest moment I'd ever known. And yet I could not believe that it was truly over. Marshall had moved away without my noticing. I looked around and found him facing back toward the amusement park, scanning the woods, alert, as if he thought that at any moment Coral herself would come running at us from the carousel. I told him, "I don't think she's coming. She might be dead."
"Good," Trey said, vehement. And at the same time, Marshall asked, "How?"
"She drank tea. She drank the tea she'd made for Trey."
Trey said, "We have to get out of here then. We should go straight down the hillside, now."
He was rising, pulling me up as well, already turning toward the downslope, though it was jagged and steep. I planted my feet, bracing against his tug. "No, I have to see." By then, Robert had calmed enough for me to tuck him back into his car seat. I bent to buckle him in, and Trey picked it up by the handle, swinging it in gentle half circles to soothe him.
"See what?" Trey asked.
"I have to see her. I need to know for certain." I began hiking perpendicular along the slope, heading back to the carousel.
"No time! We have to get out of here," Trey said.
He and Marshall were following, though. From far away, I heard the thin wail of coming sirens. Trey heard them, too.
"The police are coming already? How?"
Marshall squinted up at the sky.
"Gotta be fire trucks. I bet people can see smoke rising off this hilltop for miles and miles."
I had a different answer, though. Or Lexi called 911. She could be close. Close enough to hear the blast, which would tell her that the trade hadn't happened after all. For Lexi, that booming was a bell that tolled Robert's death, and shortly after that, her mother's. Right now, Lexi Pine thought it was over, but that would not last. I hurried on. Behind me, I could hear Marshall explaining to Trey that it was too late for us to leave. There was only one road out, and it was long. If we passed the firefighters before the first intersection, it would be obvious that we were fleeing the scene. Instead, Marshall said, we had to get our story straight.
"You get our story straight," I called over my shoulder, my voice sharp. "I have to see."
"Okay," he said, hurrying to keep up. "You have to edit the truth, just a little bit. If either of you says the wrong thing, Bree could end up in jail." "I'm a goddamn lawyer," Trey said, irritated. "I know not to incriminate my wife."
Marshall persevered.
"Don't out-clever yourself, Trey. Lawyers are used to talking. Don't. Avoid details and definitive answers, even yes and no if you can. Say, I think so, and I'm not sure, and I'm so upset it's hard to think. Only talk about the things you witnessed personally. It's fine to say, I was still in Chicago then. Meanwhile, Bree, you have to tell them that Coral was at the party. That Coral herself poisoned Spencer. You saw her there, okay?
Okay, I said. I would do whatever he said. But right now, I just cared about seeing her. Being sure. I was a little turned around, though. The woods all looked the same. I had to trust the angle of the slope to lead me back.
Marshall said, "She looked different, tell them. Black dress, makeup, a dark wig. That will explain why other guests don't recognize her from her photos. Although, with that description, a few people might say they saw her. I think it's likely, even. Eyewitness accounts are trash, and people like to feel important. Other than that, tell the truth. Tell them about seeing her twice and how she snatched Robert from the school. All you have to change are her instructions on the phone. Say she told you to get Spencer to the Orchid Center, where she would be waiting to confront him. The office log should show her trying to get that appointment earlier. Say you got him to the Orchid Center, introduced them, and then left just as instructed. Do you understand?"
We came out of the trees by the gold mine. I hurried between the boxes this time, not wanting to be slowed by that loose soil. "I understand." He kept talking anyway.
"Don't mention the pills. You introduced Trey to her, and then you left them alone because your instructions were to go straight home and wait for Robert. Everything else, you tell the truth."
"Jesus," Trey said.
"Everything?"
"Yes," Marshall said. "Our trip to Gadsden, Bree's email, your story. The fewer lies we tell, the better."
"Jesus," Trey said again.
"If the press..."
Marshall ignored him.
"Bree, you could go to prison. Are you listening?"
"I got it," I said, and I did. I'd almost reached the collapsed side of the carousel. I started running, hurrying around to the front. There was something like a heap of crumpled laundry, gray and brown and orange, on the platform. It was mostly in shade. It was very, very still. I ran toward it, saying, "Stay here," over my shoulder.
Trey said, "The hell I will."
I snapped, "Don't bring Robert near her."
That made Trey stop.
It was Marshall who trailed me all the way to the edge. I stepped up onto the carousel's tilted floor, and the heap resolved itself into her form.
"Bree,"
my husband called, a warning tone.
"I have to,"
I said. I went closer. She lay coiled on her side by the felled lion with his paint-peeled rose wreath, and her body had that heavy stillness that only comes to the dead. One arm was hooked around his pole, the hand a gnarled bird's claw, clutching nothing. Her mouth hung slack, her cheek resting in a pool of bloody foam that was already drying. Her face was red, and her gold-brown eyes were shiny and open and empty. I was filled with such a savage joy then. I wanted to scream until my raw throat gave out entirely. I wanted to kick at her corpse and beat her helpless stillness with my hands. I did none of this. I only looked down, my chest heaving. Looked closer. Her dress had come up as she flailed. Her naked legs were pale, mottled with age spots and thick veins. One foot had kicked out far enough to be in sunlight, which lit up a floss of thin hairs on her shin. She wore old-fashioned cotton drawers. They were white, with small pink flowers, like a child might wear. All the violence left me. This lifeless shape had once owned the raspy voice I'd obeyed. This lifeless shape
had once owned me. She was truly gone, and if there was a hell, then she was writhing in it, trapped in an eternal rage at the sight of my son and my husband standing together near the edge of the woods, whole. I hoped God was more merciful than that. I didn't want her ghostly eyes watching from any kind of beyond. I hoped she was in a quiet darkness. I hoped she was at last at peace. The sirens were close now. I reached out and pulled her dress down, gently, covering her underwear and the sad, wattled flesh of her thighs hanging loose from her frail bones.
"Don't touch her," Marshall said, too late. "Bree," Trey said again,
and this time I got up and went to wait with him. Marshall stuck by me, talking.
"You know what to tell them," I nodded. "Short sentences, answer only what they ask. It's good to cry and ask for breaks. It's good to say, 'I'm not sure, and I'm so upset and tired, and that it's all a blur.'"
I turned to him. "Marshall, I got it." He nodded, but he looked sick with worry. His sweetness registered. He cared so much about these details. I could not yet. I felt as if my entire body had been filled with waiting. It stretched out in front of me as far as I could see. We were on the hilltop waiting for the first responders. Once we were home, I would be waiting for Coral's letter and her daughter. I was waiting for Lexi most of all, even then. In my mind, she wasn't the woman from the mugshot, with her picked gray skin and thin hair, middle-aged and brittle. She was the fresh-faced pretty girl that Trey had known. I half expected her to come at us right now, screaming out of the trees, her wide-set eyes lamplit by rage. Robert and I both had to go and get checked out at the hospital. Everyone was so kind to me. We were the victims, after all. A policeman talked to me there, but just a little, a few questions. There would be more later. By then, I'd have a lawyer with me. Trey had called to put Letitia Marks, Gabrielle's friend, on retainer. He'd called his family, too, and his father was mobilizing a fleet of lawyers and publicists. The Cabots had a vested interest in keeping details out of the press. This distant flurry of activity mattered little to me in the moment, and yet I thought that one day I'd be grateful for it. Trey was the one who called my mother. She brought the girls home, and he sat them down and told them all an extremely expurgated version of the weekend, while I sat quiet, Robert in my lap, my daughters pressing in close against my sides. That night, Letitia sat by me in my own great room as I gave my statement to the police. Marshall had already given his. I stuck to his story, truthful about all things except that one, my answer short and broken. It was easy to follow his instructions because I could not stop crying. The whole time, Lexi Pine was a blur of motion that kept catching in the corner of my eye. I felt her breath in every breeze that touched my neck. I heard the whisper of her feet in every hallway. After Letitia and the cops left, I couldn't sleep. I lay in our big bed, staring at the window. The drapes were open, the way Trey liked them, because once the lights were off, I needed to see out. Lexi Pine had Peyton's house keys, or at least no one had found them up at fun time. Trey had already called a locksmith who was going to redo all our doors, even the back gate, tomorrow morning. As for tonight, I hoped Lexi Pine had not yet learned that her mother's business was unfinished. But I had to see for myself that she was not standing in her mother's old footprints, bending my basil plants to press her nose against our glass. Robert slept between us, my hand on his chest, so that I could feel him breathing. I looked at him then out the window to our moon-drenched, peaceful yard, back and forth again and again. The simple act of closing my eyes started a panic attack. So I watched over him until almost dawn, when I was tired enough to drift off without noticing. I dreamed the concrete stairs that led to fun time. Coral was waiting for me there. Carousel music drifted down, a garish, joyous waltz. I climbed up to find the painted animals whole again, rising and falling on golden posts. Coral rode astride a perfect lion, noble as Aslan, wreathed in living roses. As I reached the edge of the ride, she smiled at me and checked her cheap watch, and all around me, the world exploded into fire and ash. I bolted upright to find a regular, sunny Monday. Well, almost regular. Peyton and Anna Claire were in the kitchen, arguing over coconut milk yogurt flavors, as if a pair of bulky, silent ex-soldiers from the private security firm that Trey had hired weren't sitting nearby at the kitchen table. They knew that their brother had been taken by the same woman who the police believed had snuck into the gala and murdered Spencer Shaw. And yet, here they were, fussing over the last honey vanilla. Perhaps the presence of these large, armed men relaxed my anxious middle child. My oldest, I thought, was a little bit excited by it all. The drama of having bodyguards appealed to her. She lost out on the yogurt in the end because she was too involved in 9 simultaneous group chats to fight for it. I had to remind myself that they hadn't known about Robert's absence until it was over. They'd been at their grandma's, making cookies, sleeping in. He was safe before they ever knew he'd been in danger. My mother was still upstairs, asleep in a guest room. She had been more upset than the girls, too upset to go home. But also, strangely vindicated. She didn't say out loud that this proved the world was as black-hearted as she'd always said. She didn't have to. I'd made her promise to go home this morning and make an appointment with her doctor, maybe go back on her anti-anxiety medication for a little. I thought I ought to find us all therapists, ones who specialized in trauma. I wanted mine to have an MD so she could write prescriptions. Prescriptions sounded pretty good. I made avocado toast for Anna Claire, wondering how I could stand to let them go to school. I wanted to keep things normal for them as much as I could. In the end, I put Robert in his car seat and drove them myself. An ex-Army Ranger named Mills went with us. His partner, Maxwell, discreetly followed in a dark sedan. It was a strange ride. Mills was young and beautiful, built like a movie star with a low fade haircut and a gun. Anna Claire kept leaning up between the seats to ask him questions about his job and his military service and whether or not he was a dog person. She was both overconfidently flirty and 13 years old, which made poor Mills wildly uncomfortable. He kept cutting his eyes at me, giving short, awkward answers, while Peyton giggled. I couldn't help him. The closer we got to St. Albans, the tighter my chest screwed shut around my lungs. Robert had been stolen from this very campus. In the carpool line, I gripped the wheel so tight that the blood drained from my hands. It was all I could do to let the girls get out and go inside. Then I sat frozen until the cars stuck behind me started tapping their horns in brief, polite peeps. I pulled forward out of the way, but leaving wasn't possible. I parked on the road across from the main entrance and turned the car off, in spite of Mills's puzzled glances. I told him we would go home soon. He texted his partner, and Maxwell parked behind me. We waited. I don't know what they were doing, but I was watching for Lexi Pine. After a while, I turned the car off and cracked my windows to let the pleasant air circulate. I wasn't going anywhere. Mills and I lived out of Robert's diaper bag all day. I had protein bars and fresh diapers and formula and bottled water. I downloaded a light, sweet audiobook about misunderstandings at a wedding and played it to pass the time. Mills probably hated it. Around 1, Maxwell had pizza and soft drinks delivered right to our cars. It was from some chain, thick with plastic-looking pepperoni and cheap rubbery cheese. It tasted better than it looked. Marshall called around 2, just to check on me, he said. I'd been texting with Trey on and off, but I hadn't told my husband I was hanging around outside the school like a sex offender. I told Marshall, though. When I try to leave, or even look away from the building, I panic. It's ridiculous. There's an armed ex-Marine in the car behind me who'll be here all day. But apparently, I think it's my magic presence that keeps them safe. Mills sat beside me, stoic, trying to pretend he wasn't listening.
So don't drive them tomorrow, Marshall said. Let Trey handle it.
It was simple and pragmatic, and it worked. Tuesday, I kissed them goodbye and let them go on to the school with their father and Maxwell. Mills stayed with me. After that, I couldn't leave the house. Panic trilled up my spine at the very idea of stepping outside, being visible and exposed. I wanted walls around me and my son. I wanted more ex-soldiers dotted around my yard like points on a compass. I called the school office to make sure the girls had been checked into the system at homeroom. I couldn't let Robert out of my sight. I liked him best bound to me in his sling. I tried not to think about how Coral's body had so recently been in place of mine, how my son had been tied to her, his flutter-fast heart beating beside hers. The only thing that got me out the door was the arrival of the mail around 11. I left Robert asleep in a bouncy chair by Mills and went to get it. I wanted to be the one to intercept Coral's letter. By then, I wasn't waiting for it so much as I was resigned to it. It wasn't there, though. Not yet. Just a stack of junk. I closed the mailbox, impatience and relief at war in me, and my cell phone rang. I juggled the pile of mail into one arm, then pulled it out of my back jeans pocket. It was Marshall. He was mostly checking up on me, but he also had updates he'd gleaned from his sources about the ongoing investigation. Coral hadn't used the detonator she'd had hidden under her afghan. That had been her backup. The explosion had been caused by a chemical timer. "I told you she wasn't bluffing," I said, sitting down on one of the wrought iron chairs on my front porch. At the end, she kept saying I was out of time, that it was too late to call Trey up. I didn't understand. There was more. He remembered his promise that we would contact Kelly Wilkerson once this was all over. He now thought we shouldn't. Kelly was no longer a person of interest. We'd told the police that Coral had taken Jeff, though no body had been found. I wondered what explanation her husband would offer. How well would it match Trey's? He wouldn't make himself the villain, surely. In his story, would he follow Trey and Spence upstairs at all? We agreed there was no need to bother Kelly. She had grief enough, and whatever her husband's story, I didn't want to hear it. Depressing topic, but I wanted to keep talking. Marshall had gotten Robert back. Listening to his voice, even as we discussed these awful things, was the safest I'd felt since we got home. But he needed to call Trey and update him, too. I let him go and went back inside to check on Robert, though I'd scarcely been away from him 5 minutes. I went to the kitchen to sort out bills and put the junk mail in recycling, thinking. Coral had mailed her letter from in-state. It should come in the next day or two. I hadn't told anyone about it. Not Trey or the police or Gabrielle or even Letitia, who insisted that she was my lawyer and I should tell her everything. I hadn't even told Marshall. I had a decision to make first. Would I open it or burn it? No story that Coral would tell could possibly match Trey's. How could it, considering the source? Coral could know only what Lexi had shared with her. By all accounts, Coral Lee Pine had been a strict and difficult parent. In the expurgated for mother version, Lexi would not have confessed that she was the source for the drugs, or about the first threesome with Spence and Bonnie, or that she had been the one to suggest another one with Trey. Nothing, Lexi told her mother, would mitigate what those three boys had done. I hoped that I would burn it. The letter would not contain anything I could believe. Why give Coral's version any space inside my head? Coral Lee Pine was a poisoner, and she had dripped enough darkness into me already. And yet, I could still feel the cord of our strange connection. She'd written to me. I wanted to read it. All this churning, and still the letter was only paper. Lexi was her mother's flesh and blood, her will and fury. Until they found Lexi, I could not feel safe or believe that this was truly over. I wanted her caught, even if it meant she exposed my ugly role in Spence's death. Marshall had told me to lie if that happened, deny it, accuse Lexi of protecting her mother's memory or still trying to lash out at my family. It would be my word against hers, and I was a Cabot. She was a junkie. My lie held more weight than her truth. But that echoed back against her history and my own in ways that sickened me. Nevertheless, I had told him I would do it.
She's probably left the state anyway, Trey said late that night, when he woke at 2 to find me mulling all this over, my hand resting on Robert's busy little heart. The guys I've hired are a precaution. If she has any sense, she's long gone.
I'm sure you're right, I'd whispered back, with absolutely no conviction. For all Coral had said she was leaving her child out of it, I knew how dirty Lexi's hands were. She had helped her mother stalk a toddler. Maybe she hadn't known Coral's plan in the beginning, but after Jeff's murder, she'd still helped Coral watch me. She'd let her mother take my child, too. Now Coral was dead, with her plan only 2/3 complete. Would Lexi feel she had to finish it? She didn't come from a family who let things go. The next day, the mail came at 11, right on time. I put Robert into his bouncy chair and left him with Mills again. I walked down the drive, feeling Lexi's eyes on me with every step I took. I opened the mailbox, and there it was. I knew it at once. It was a white cardboard thing, the size of a sheet of paper, tucked between the smaller bills and larger catalogs. The only words on it were my name and address, the handwriting small and spidery, the letters crabbed together. No return address. I grabbed the whole stack and hurried back inside. In my head, in the 2 minutes I'd been gone, Lexi had vaulted over the back fence, kicked down my back door, and taken Robert. It was a relief to see him peacefully napping in his chair, his pink mouth working a dream bottle. Mills looked up from his book.
Everything okay?
Uh-huh, I said, trying to calm my breathing. Can you sit with him? I'd love to grab a shower. He should sleep at least until noon, and I'll have the baby monitor in case he wakes.
Sure,
Mills said. He was good with Robert, I'd discovered. Giant Mills, with his 8-pack and his hooded eyes, liked babies. His sister had 2 kids, he said. I found it touching, even sweet. And these days, I took sweetness anywhere I found it. I brought the mail back to my bedroom. I locked the door and leaned against it. I would not read the letter, I decided. There was nothing Coral Lee Pine could tell me that was true. It would do me no good at all. I would take it to the master bath and burn it in the sink. I had a lighter in there for my scented candles. Trey had told me he saw our family as a bullseye after Anna Claire was born. The baby in the middle, us around the baby in concentric circles. I realized now a bullseye was a target. I could not weaken us with Lexi still unfound and maybe aimed at us. I had to keep Robert and his sister safe at center, and I wanted Trey wrapped tight around them. To not read was to choose to wrap around them all, my husband included. I dropped the pile of mail on the bed, then fished her envelope out from between the bills and glossy catalogs. I was halfway to the bathroom before I registered the small red stamps running in a chain along the edge. A long envelope from Visa had hidden the words before. Photographs do not bend. Photographs do not bend. Photographs do not bend.